I'd like to apologize for a late start. The chairperson did indicate yesterday she was not going to be available this morning. The whip, who was supposed to chair the meeting this morning, has been now called into the chairpersons and whips forum. It's just indicated so to me. And I therefore wish to extend his apology as well, the whip of the committee, the Honorable Peggy Khadere. You're all welcome. Those who have been here from the start of this public hearings and those who have come in this morning. We welcome the officials of the department led by the DDG, Ms. Ntuli. We welcome all the stakeholders who have an interest in this matter of the National Credit Amendment Bill. We also welcome the members of the Portfolio Committee and the staff and members of the media. Let me check with the Secretary if there are any further apologies besides the chairperson's and the whip's apology. Yes, Dr. James of the Democratic Alliance is not attending this morning. He has other commitments. We also want to extend Dr. Ambrosini's long-standing apology because of his being unwell. Other than that, we don't have any other apology. Can we then move the adoption of the agenda? The Honorable Wiley moves. Second, Honorable McIntosh. Thank you very much. We have a couple of presenters here today, Mr. S. Mantel, who will start, followed by Capital Software, and then National Clothing Retail Federation of South Africa will follow, and lastly, the Black Debt Councillors Forum, in that order. But after each presentation, we will open space for questions and clarifications and other engagements. We might ask the department as well to make inputs if that becomes necessary. They will indicate so if they so wish to. Let's start with Mr. Mantel.
Hi, my name is Simon Mantel. I'm the owner of a biscuit factory called Mantelli's. I'm an employer of blue-collar South African workers. I have a financial background, and in August 2012, I wrote an opinion piece in Business Day on the five ways that microlending was strangling the South African economy. That article, that opinion piece in Business Day, was the kernel for creating a whole lot of awareness on the pernicious behavior in the microlending industry. Shortly after that, Marikana followed, and it then became aware that one of the reasons for Marikana was emolument attachment orders. I then wrote another opinion piece in Business Day, which was, I think, around about November 2012, providing the solutions. But what I want to do now that I've just introduced myself, I'm going to run through a couple of points that I'd like to touch on, and then hopefully you'll have some questions for me at the end. As a business person, as an employer, I want to touch on the purposes of the National Credit Act as an open as it was, and possibly the amendment bill, where it affects blue-collar workers. I want to provide a practical example of a credit agreement which affects millions of blue-collar workers. This isn't an isolated incident. It affects millions of blue-collar workers. Then I want to dissect this credit agreement and hopefully illustrate to you that the National Credit Act is fatally flawed, and in fact any amendment to the National Credit Act is futile. I'm going to summarise the five ways in which the credit provision as it stands at the moment is strangling the economy, and then hopefully I'm going to be able to highlight what I believe is a practical solution to ensure that affordable credit gets to the masses, because that's what true black economic empowerment is about. I believe that we're at a fork in the road, and it requires significant conviction by decision makers to choose the right fork. But if we continue down the road that we're on, we're on a road to disaster. I'd like to just quickly ask the committee, how many of you really grasp compound interest? How many of you have a sound understanding of compound interest? Jordan, let me ask you a question. If I lent you 100 Rand and it's simple interest, it's 20% per annum over 5 years, just give me a quick estimate of what you think you'll repay me at the end of 5 years.
Can we be a bit orderly? Give us your presentation.
Yes, okay. We'll give
it those
issues. Anyway, right. But I think what I'm trying to say is that, before we get on to this, that most educated people with a tertiary education don't understand compound interest. And what we're doing is we are giving credit. Credit is being allowed in a format where people who are financially illiterate and innumerate, they will never grasp compound interest based on their education levels. And it's an unfair playing field. But let me just touch on the purposes of the National Credit Act. As I understood it, some of them was to promote and advance social and economic welfare of South Africans, promote a fair, competitive, responsible and accessible credit industry, and very importantly, to promote a credit market that is accessible, particularly to those who have historically been unable to access credit. That's the vital point. And if I look at the objective of the bill, one of the objectives of the bill is to empower the National Credit Tribunal to suspend reckless credit agreements. But what I hope to show you here today is if that's the case, then the National Credit Tribunal should be suspending almost every credit agreement that exists. So I'd ask you to turn to your pack that you've got. I'm going to give an example of an employee who in 2006 borrowed 10,000 Rand from African Bank. The repayment period or the loan period was 18 months. On the statement which you will see, and I'll take you to page, if you look at your pack, if you look at B, you'll see that the principal debt is 10,765 Rand. Now in fact the principal debt was 10,765 Rand represents a raising fee of 7.5%. So to put it into perspective, if you were to take a mortgage bond, and this is what I'm trying to illustrate, is that part of the Credit Act is it's meant to be fair for everyone, but if you, as a middle-class South African, applied for a bond, imagine being charged 7.5% raising fee on a mortgage bond. It makes no sense. So in this agreement with this employee of mine, she borrowed 10,776 Rand, including raising fees. Annual rate of interest shows 15%. Yet her repayment is 1,049 Rand a month. So in 18 months, she's going to pay 18,900 Rand on a 10,000 Rand loan. The effective interest rate is 92%. However, that is built up in a number of ways. So what happens is the staff member, they sign them up for life cover. So her life premium was 108 Rand a month. on a 10,000 rand principal debt. Now, if you go to Sanlam or Momentum or one of the big insurance companies, 100 rand a month will buy you 150,000 rands worth of life cover. So basically, that employee is paying 15 times what she should be paying, and bearing in mind that that debt is a, it should be reducing terms. In fact, her premium should be reducing. Now, every month, those charges are debited to her accounts. She's paying compound interest on that at this exorbitant rate. And if you have a look at F, her first monthly interest rate on the 30th of the 4th, 2006, it amounted to 70% annualized. So notwithstanding what is in the agreement, those are what the realities are. On top of that, her bank charges, including VAT, are 57 or 58 rand a month. That amounts to 6.5% or more on her loan amount. So imagine you borrowing money and you're paying 6.5% just bank charges. It makes no sense. So as a result, you have to then ask yourself, someone borrowing 10,000 rand, how can they firstly afford 1,049 rand a month? You know, we want to create a country where people can maybe borrow money, they can develop businesses. So imagine if this lady who was working for me was wanting to start a small business on her own. She can't go and get an affordable loan. And I think if this gets the nub of it, good, where it gets even worse, it illustrates the unholy alliance between the credit providers, and these are public listed companies. We're not talking about the loan sharks on the street corner. These are public listed companies, firms of attorneys who specialize in debt collecting, and the judicial system. Because what happened to this lady was, after 2 years, you'll see if you go to page D, by the 9th of March 2007, she'd reduced her principal debt to 4,300 rand from 10,000, notwithstanding the onerous repayments that she had to make. The wheels then fell off, and it's not something that affects only blue-collar workers. Most people, when they get into debt, they put their head in the sand, and they just hope it'll go away. And if you go to page E, by the 30th of the 6th, 2012, her debt had now become 21,890 rand. And what happened was, African Bank handed this over to a firm of, a debt-collecting firm of attorneys, and the Simonstown Magistrates Court, and this is an unholy alliance where the judicial system isn't applying its mind to these matters. The magistrate awarded an emolument attachment order in the amount of 21,000 rand. So this is someone who's borrowed 10,000 rand, they've got it down to 4,000, and now they have to pay back 21,000 rand at 1,049 rand a month. Now, what this was the example that got me to write this a piece for Business Day. I then got hold of African Bank, and what was interesting about it was suddenly the rules changed. Now they were dealing with me, and they said, look, as a gesture of goodwill, we'll write off 11,000 rand of that. That cannot be right. Now, this example, and if I look, probably 30% of my employees have got emolument attachment orders. And I would say that my business is very reflective of what is happening in the country. So this is not an isolated example, and that is my point, is that the National Credit Act, the noble intention was to prevent this sort of thing happening, but this is common practice. Now I want to touch on why it's strangling the economy. So what we have, we've got exorbitant hidden costs. So in a typical loan like this, the effective interest rate is 92%. In the vast amount of cases, all this credit that's provided is a debt rollover, so people are replacing one loan with another loan. I mean, that is what happens, that's my experience. The borrower is set up to fail, because there's absolutely no way that you can service interest rate of 92%. And all of us, I'm sure, will agree with that. You're effectively sentencing the majority of blue-collar, hard-working South Africans to debt prison. The whole idea, do we want to have a system, a feudal system, where the blue-collar worker remains a serf in our country, or do we want to create an opportunity where they can not only dream, but be able to realize their dreams? And what this is doing is this is suffocating people. Reduce disposable income, because this is the most important thing. What happens is, in this particular case, this lady who worked for me, she borrows 10,000 rand. Her repayment is 1,049. So let's say she's earning 5,000 rand a month. 20% of that is to service, with all due respect, a Mickey Mouse loan. You know, imagine, I'm sure in this room, the majority of people here have some debt or other, whether it be long-term, but imagine having a bond of 25 or 30%. It's unworkable, and we cannot continue in this vein. One of the things that all the public listed credit providers, and it, whether it relates to the retailers of white goods, fridges, clothing, micro-lending banks, they keep talk about we providing credit to the unbanked. We providing unsecured credit. Now that they've misled officials, they've misled anyone. The reason why I say that is that whether it's an African bank or whoever it might be, they will only lend money to someone who is employed. They won't lend money to someone who's unemployed, and they know that if that person reneges or lapse, if their repayments lapse, they know that they can obtain an emolument attachment order. In fact, they want to get an emolument attachment order because it takes all the pain out of the collection. It's automatically done. So unless that employee loses their job, they guaranteed repayment. In fact, emolument attachment orders play into the hands of the credit providers. So this thing about unsecured, and that's why the interest rate is a lot higher, is not practical and accurate. It isn't the truth. So then the case is, how do we come up with a solution that can give the unbanked or people who don't have access to affordable credit, how does one do it? So I'm going to give you the practical example of an employer, what happens when someone applies for credit. So the first thing is, first thing that happens when someone gets a payslip, they go and they apply for credit. The credit provider will phone the employer, confirm employment, at every stage, the employer is actually involved in the credit providing process because they're having to do paperwork, they're having to confirm employment, weekly wages or monthly wages, whatever the case is. So that's the first step. The second step is when that employee gets into trouble, the employee always gives the employer's contact numbers as the contact to the credit provider. So that means that my human resources department is dealing with calls all day long from credit providers chasing up on people. And then eventually when the sheriff arrives, there's another process involved because now we have to get the employee in, we need to counsel them, we need to explain to someone who's not financially literate or numerate, explain to them why suddenly now a magistrate in Simonstown has awarded 1,000 rand emolument attachment order. And we then have to counsel them and explain that and say there's nothing that we can do. All of that takes time. So, ironically, as an employer, although your employees are getting credit elsewhere, it's your problem whether you like it or not. And then on top of it, you're sitting with a situation where you have employees who are demotivated. Imagine working really hard in a factory and having 25% of your salary knocked off an emolument attachment order, particularly when it's wrong, like this example of African Bank. So now what is the solution? And I think this is the nub of it. So if you work from the premise that credit, the majority of credit is provided to employees who are employed, that is the first point. So how does one then involve government and private enterprise together? Because this is the only way we can achieve a solution. And my practical approach, you might say, well, I have a small business, I'll look at it simply. But often the simple solutions are the answers. Whether I like it or not, I'm involved with my staff or Staff who work for me are involved in dealing with the credit provision. So this is what I would suggest that the DTI do. They set up a database for credit managing employers. That's the first thing. And as a credit managing employer, that attracts BEE score on the BEE scorecard. And it becomes a motivational factor for employers. And typically, unless you're talking large public listed companies, typically there's a close relationship between small and medium enterprise and their workers. 65 to 70% of blue collar workers in this country are employed in small, medium sized business. So the first element that you have is you then say, there's a database of credit managing employers. Then what happens is debt needs to be consolidated. So I'm giving the example that I bank the Standard Bank, our business bank the Standard Bank. One piece of legislation has to be passed, whereas then you've got on the one side you have the database where you get the BEE points. The next thing that you have is you then say to the employers, consolidate all their debt and have debt with one bank. So for example, if I have an employee who has 20,000 rands worth of debt, and she is now, she's got debt with Woolworths, African Bank, Edgars, you name it, Standard Bank, I can vouch for her because I know her. Standard Bank consolidates all that debt and she has one line of credit. And then the key to it then is there's legislation passed where if an employer is a registered credit managing employer and the debt has been consolidated with one bank, and in a particular case like that, if I'm paying an emolument attachment order and we're already doing an EFT, it's far easier just to do it to Standard Bank. But now I can say to Standard Bank, this lady has worked for us for 15 or 20 years, give her credit at 15%, no life cover, no retrenchment cover, she's good to go. She's now getting credit at 15%. And then what happens is, how you cut off the rest of it, you say, that employee, if she seeks credit elsewhere, the onus is on the credit provider. So let's say she goes somewhere else, they must check to see whether she's employed by a credit managing employer. And then what happens is me as the employer, I simply refuse to grant credit. Or I have that authority to say, right, well, another credit provider, if you want to now provide credit to this employee, it's unsecured. And that's the rule. Then there's no garnishing orders on those. So that eventually, it'll dry up all that irresponsible unsecured credit. And now what happens is we have a situation where I have an employee who's got a revolving credit facility of, let's say, 20,000. She's paying at an affordable rate. The bank, whoever the credit provider is, has the opportunity to email, communicate with us every month. We can explain to the staff. So now we're training them on how you get financed, what it means. And this is the point. It requires involvement by the employer and government together. That is the vital fact. I believe that this is a framework that can work, but certainly it's worth a try. If I look at the system as it's what's happened up until now, and I remember as a child, we had staff, and I remember the excitement of buying a new lounge suite, and 3 months later being repossessed in the days of the furniture stores, and nothing has actually changed, and that's the sad thing, that's 40 years ago. And if I look at it now, 40 years have passed and we've actually made no progress. And I can't believe that that's right. I can't believe that to create more and more complicated legislation, there's always going to be a way around it. My profession originally, I'm a chartered accountant. And with attorneys and chartered accountants, they'll always find a way to make another plan. And I think that this way of involving employers, letting them manage it. And the irony is you might say, well, you know, how can it be that an employer can manage the credit of an employee? What gives them the right? Well, ironically, I don't know what a parliamentarian salary is, but let's say it's R1 million a year. If a parliamentarian went and decided they wanted to buy a R10 million car and they needed finance, the bank would say no. The bank would say, based on your salary, we're not going to finance that car. And yet, ironically, people who have nothing, who also don't comprehend all the facts, there's no control. You know, so in other words, almost as you move up the pecking order, the bank manages what you can and what you can't do. But yet when you at the bottom of the ladder and you're trying to move up, credit providers are just saying, well, go mad. That can't make sense. Are there any questions?
Yeah, okay. Let's do just that now. Can I see all the hands that want to raise questions and clarities? Honorable McIntosh, Honorable Hill Lewis, Honorable Mabasa, Honorable Wayile, Honorable Sonibo.
Mr. Mantel, can I first of all say you're a great South African and a great employer, and I think we're all very proud of what you're concerned about and the issues you're raising. I think it's always a challenge, and it was brought up in another presentation, that there are actually two, well, not necessarily two, but there are different economies in South Africa, and for low-earning blue-collar workers, regardless of colour, their concept and understanding of debt and loans is very simple, and they're not educated, in many cases, even into doing a proper budget for the family finances and everything. Not to suggest that they're not careful, but poorer people have ways of financing. There's a thing like a stock fill. In the Western Cape, there's a lay-by system which people developed. I'm sure you would know that, because I presume you're from the Western Cape. And if you are a farmer, as I am, the people also have a way of cooperating with the landowner, the farmer, to access credit and funding. So I think we must understand that if you're into the micro-lending world, you're dealing with people who need the money, and they often need it very urgently, and they often want it in small amounts. Now, my concern with your proposal is that, will it actually be practical? And if, for example, your employee, this lady, had come to you when she still only owed R4,000 and said to you, please, Mr. Mantel, can you not help me and phone African Bank and come to some arrangement with them? So there is a responsibility on the consumer as well, the person who borrows the money. Now, that to me is the challenge, because although Marikana, it was a horror for all of us in South Africa, the attempt to pin Marikana onto emolument orders is, I think, to use an old English word, sophistry, or in Afrikaans is a better word, drog redenasie. But that was an element in the desire, because everybody accepts no work, no pay. And people have financial requirements, and they're using micro-lenders in many cases as bridging finance, or somebody in one of the presentations said, in a real sense, responsible micro-lending is the poor's overdraft. They can get the money, they can get somewhere. But my real question to you is, supposing your lady employee had come to you when she only owed R4,000, what would you have done?
Thank you very much, Chair and Mr. Mantel. I think
respond to all of them. Can I request members to cut down on preambles and get to the real bone of the question so that we can save time?
Look, firstly, the presentation is really disturbing and harrowing, and I would have loved for you to have been here yesterday when we had a representative from every bank in the country, because I would have loved to have put that statement to them and said, explain this, because every time we ask them for an explanation, they say, oh, well, it's not us, it must be some other bank doing that, or it's not us, it must be some other bank. And I think you've put it for us in very stark and harrowing terms. I also actually really like the proposal that you make in terms of reform of or inclusion of that aspect into the BEE scorecard. I think that's a really positive incentive-based way to deal with it. But if I look through your five strangleholds on the economy, I don't agree with you that we can't deal with some of those things in this bill. You know, a great deal of your employees' debt was because of all the outrageous fees and extras that this particular person had to pay for. And, you know, most starkly represented in the 108 Rand for life insurance, which is absolutely iniquitous. Now, we can deal with some of that stuff in this bill. We can introduce caps on credit life insurance. We can introduce further caps on charges and admin fees. We can force credit providers to disclose in a much more clear and easily understandable way exactly what the cost of credit is going to be on a monthly basis in total. So there are things that we can do on each of these points to unlock this debt prison. And I'd just like to hear your thoughts on some of those things.
Thank you, Colleague Chair. The gist of the message from Mr. Mantel is appreciated, where you illustrate how the working class get trapped into debt. But coming to marrying your comments with the bill, how do you propose we improve the bill such that it takes into account your concerns, so that you come out with clear proposals to say you propose that the bill be improved in 1, 2, 3 ways? So what are those specifics that you would propose be articulated in the bill? Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Honourable White.
Thanks very much, Colleague Chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. I think one question has been posed by Honourable Mabas, because one of the important things that this exercise is an exercise that is has got clear stated objectives. And as we're sitting here, there are a number of expectations, especially from the downtrodden people who are serving life sentences, some of them, but they want to see solutions. And those solutions will come from all the different social partners who are around here. But one of the questions which I want to pose is by virtue that you are an employer, what is the relationship and the collaboration that exists between the employers, the judiciary, because I've heard that you had a tongue lashing against the judiciary, and also the service provider, especially in the process of the garnishee order. because we find that number of workers find themselves in the Ganeshi order without themselves participating in that particular process. That also includes the process of administration, because workers at times think the administration is the best way to run. What is it that you have seen as a serious problem in that value chain? The other question, which is the last one, relates to, because the GTI and the government, all of ourselves, including the National Planning Commission, want the South Africa with a thriving economy, an economy that must employ, but also an economy that must ensure that the prosperity of that economy is shared by all the people. It's unfortunate that the working class always bear the brunt of all these negative impacts. But the question that I want to drive home is what are the negative impacts to the productivity levels? Because that's what is fundamental, and at times we talk technical, but some of these issues, I happen to be a shop steward for years in the tire industry. I know at some stage that there will be far-reaching impacts on the productivity as a result of the workers' indebtedness. But also the last point, how many of the workers who have resigned opting to get the provident funds or pension funds as to mitigate the crisis they are confronted with. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, I think it's commendable that you take an interest in your staff and that you are helping them sort out these problems. I think many employers could learn from that. But as an accountant as well, I'm not entirely sure what your solution is to the compound interest question. And it would be, I would be keen to see how you would finance that 10,000 rand loan. Excluding, of course, I think you have a point when it comes to excessive costs. When you're looking at the excessive legal fees, if you look at the credit lives, etc., I think you have a point there, but that is something which is being discussed in this committee, and that's the whole purpose of us looking at this National Credit Amendment Act, is to look at how one contains costs, etc., and makes credit more affordable. But I don't think, I don't understand what the problem is with compound interest, and I would like to see how you would finance it, because if you are going to finance it on a straight interest model, you'll have to push up the cost of finance, and you're going to make it less affordable for people to get it, because you have to take affordability into account as well. And then the one thing that I was just stuck into my mind was what you're proposing. Could it not be, I'm asking the question now, I mean, it's just been put on the table, so I have to think it through, but could it not be considered to be a little patriarchal in the sense that you will now be taking decisions on behalf of your staff and how they can access credit and not access credit? Is that not sort of impeding staff's freedoms to choose how they want to manage their own lives? I understand they need to be educated, but surely you can't take their freedom away how they want to manage their own lives. So those are just a couple of thoughts which enter my mind.
Over to you, Mr. Mattel.
Okay, I think the question was when my staff member got to 4,000 Rand, what would I have done if she was running into problems? Well, I would have got hold of African Bank at that stage and said, look, one of my employees would have phoned in to find out what could have been done and, you know, to inform them. But I think the nature of it is that people they wait for the ship to sail before they deal with it, and that's probably how I would have dealt with it and manage it.
Some cell phone keeps on whistling to all of us here. Can it be turned off, please?
Your question on the... Are you happy with that answer? Are you happy with that answer? No, I just want to know whether you're happy with the answer. Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Wait.
Just provide the answer.
Okay.
If people want to do follow-ups, they can do that afterwards.
You asked for maybe what could be done on the bill as far as admin fees, caps go. Possibly that could be done, but you know what I'm saying is if I look at the original National Credit Act, it was meant to control all of those things, and I don't think that we have the agencies to control what is actually done. You know, so in other words, do you then legislate and say, well, there is no life cover offered? And what happens is always the option of opt-in or opt-out, and I just believe that irrespective of what, I mean, you can't tell me that when the National Credit Act was originally gazetted, you can't tell me that the intention was to see someone like African Bank effectively charging someone 93%. It was meant to combat that, and that's why I don't believe that in its current form it can achieve that. In terms of, I think, your question was, how would you improve the bill? I think my answer to the previous question is that I think it's very difficult based on the fact that the system has been so abused. You know, I don't think that there's good faith in it, and for that reason, I can't see practically how one can work one's way around that to have something that's functioning. Your question on the judiciary garnishee order, you know, my view of it is that has a magistrate applied his or her mind, seeing that the principal debt was 10,000 rands, and in 2012, he or she awards an emoluments attachment order in the amount of 21,000. As I understood with the National Credit Act, you can only go up to whatever the principal debt was. So to me, that's the one element. So in other words, some magistrates just rubber stamping these things. The other issue with the legal system is that what's happening is that the debt collecting attorneys, typically they will buy debt up. So let's say it's a Cape Town employee, you'll have a firm of attorneys in Nelspruit who do the collecting. So what they'll do is the matter will be before Magistrates Court in Nelspruit, meaning that the employee has got no chance of ever representing him or herself. So that's that side as far as that's concerned. Is you asked me about how does it negatively impact the economy and, you know, the DTI looking from that, I think it has a tremendously destructive influence on productivity in the country. So, you know, you mentioned you were a shop steward, you'd been on the floor. Most of the people in this room haven't done probably physical work. You know, the business that I worked with my employees, I've done that physical work at one or other stage. And I tell you, when you're doing physical menial work, the psychological damage, knowing that at the end of that week, at the end of that month, 1,000 rands being deducted, it definitely destroys your morale. And in fact, even just think of all of you. If you are in debt or you've got a bit of a financial problem, it doesn't matter what station you are in life. It's highly damaging and it affects productivity. You know, what is the incentive to work if you know that you're going to have 25% of your wages deducted at the end of the month? You know, it's iniquitous. Moving on to your question of a bit patriarchal, I think the example that I gave is that if you go to the bank and you want to buy a Bugatti for 10 million rand, the bank's not going to finance you. Ironically, as you move up the chain, the bank who's providing the credit is going to say you can't afford a house for 25 million, you can't afford the bond repayment. So whether we like it or not, we are told what credit we can access. You know, I mean, that's how it is. And getting back to, you know, I'm not saying as far as an employer is concerned that you have to tell the staff which way to go, but they can elect. So if I've got a staff of 50 people and 40 of them say we want to go on to your program, what's happened is the retail banks don't have the access to get to all those millions of workers, but ironically they're banking all the principal employers. So the cost can be cut down. So literally what happens is, in my case, Standard Bank would come to me, I could point out all the workers, say, who would like to have a line of credit? What is your credit? It's, let's say they've got 20,000 rand across a range of accounts, and then say, right, what is going to happen is Standard Bank are going to, you're going to sign a loan with Standard Bank, and you only have one line of credit. And I will do the EFT every month. So Standard Bank are getting the interest, but they might be charging 15%. The collection fees are reduced because what's happened is Standard Bank, in my particular case, they know that I'm a business that's not about to go bust. They know that I've got a stable workforce. And what's happening is now we slowly start phasing in, and you work it like that. You can have a two-tier system so that there is a choice, and that then becomes the key. So Standard Bank are not, there's no risk of bad debt or very little risk, because obviously I've vetted my employees, I know what they can afford, and then they have a revolving credit. And the beauty of that is you can then have the names of the staff on the board, and they've got almost like a community chest score on where they are. And when they then want to go and buy a microwave, they don't have to go and buy a microwave with 40% interest. They can go to Macro and they can buy it for cash because they've paid in, and much the way, like if you look at Stockpulse or whatever, that's how you manage that process. So all of the time they've got this line of credit, but government has passed the legislation that if an employee is employed by an employer who's registered as a credit managing employer, and that that employer doesn't grant them credit elsewhere, they need to get clearance from the employer. They've still got their line of credit, but they're getting credit at a very affordable rate. And that is the hub. And there's no collection, because if I'm paying a garnish or an emolument attachment order, what's the difference between me doing that and paying Standard Bank via EFT every month? You know, you really make it affordable. And, you know, my calculation was it would probably put about another 100 billion into the economy every year. By making credits more affordable to the masses, there's that for the fiscus. But not only that, you have a situation where people have more disposable income. A 100 billion, to put 100 billion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mantel. Could we ask you to give us in writing a very succinct presentation on what you propose should be added into the amendments of the bill? That would be very helpful. Thank you very much. Next is Capital Software. Mr. Jacques de Vet, can we just request, if you have a PowerPoint presentation, you have it? Okay, so thank you very much. All right.
I think we all agree that in the past there was the act was somewhat vague. There was perhaps not so much clarity and certainty regarding objective criteria to regulate payments, and for that reason we support the insertion of this clause. However, what we do see is that there's no reference to the National Payment Systems Act, and specifically Directives 1 and 2 of 2007. We see that in the Act there are references, where appropriate, to other relevant legislation, for example the Banks Act. But when the provision that is inserted to specifically regulate payments, we find that there is cause for some concern that no reference is specifically made to the National Payment Systems Act and Directives 1 and 2 of 2007. We feel this is also an opportunity where we can make provision for those scenarios where either a DC has the capacity or capability, both with in-house expertise or outside outsourced expertise, to make payments. And we also feel there's an opportunity to specifically look into the scenario where a consumer has the freedom of choice to elect to make the payments himself. Ultimately, the consumer is liable to the creditor, and the anomaly we have at the moment is that if the PDA either fails to make payment or makes payment incorrectly, the consumer nevertheless loses his house. So I feel that we should all be focused on certainty. We heard yesterday very good suggestions around codes of conduct, and whether we call it directives, regulation or codes of conduct, it would be beneficial to the consumer if there was certainty regarding his freedom of choice in those scenarios. I also feel there's an opportunity here to address what we view as the excessive cost charged by the PDAs. We all acknowledge, I think, that the PDAs is an additional cost in the process. I think that's agreed by most. And if I may just use an example to illustrate, I think currently, I'm open to correction on the exact numbers, but if a payment between 100 and 200 Rand is made, there's a charge of 7 or 8 Rand. If the amount is between 200 and 500 Rand, there's a charge of 15 or 20 Rand. And if the value is greater than 500 Rand, the charge is 30 Rand. In fact, I believe there's also scenarios where there's a percentage of the value as a charge. In our view, I think it's acknowledged in the payment industry that a payment is a payment is a payment. In other words, we all use sophisticated software to process these payments, and the cost associated to paying 10 Rand is exactly the same to the cost associated to pay 10 million Rand. And it is therefore our submission that there's an opportunity to investigate the costs, especially considering the fact that these costs directly impact the consumer and in many cases the poorest of the poor. I think yesterday there was a submission where they did a simple analysis that indicated that there were literally hundreds of millions of rands that could have been allocated to the early settlement of debt. We also believe that there should be broader competition in the market, because we fully support the regulation, and we believe that within the ambit of that regulation there can always be competition, and ironically more competition increases service levels and reduces cost. Therefore, with that background in mind, our specific recommendations are as follows. With regards to Section 44A, we would recommend that specific reference is made to the National Payment Systems Act and Directives 1 and 2 of 2007, that there's a requirement to register in terms of the NPS Act and those directives, that there is some requirement for experience in terms of the payments industry, that there be a concerted attempt to reduce the costs to industry standard norms, where payments are made at a fixed price per transaction as opposed to an ad valorem or percentage of value model, and that the savings that can be made on behalf of consumers in this regard can be allocated to the early settlement of debt, that in referencing the National Payment Systems Act, we're going to achieve what is clearly ensconced in the NPS Act, which is equal and fair access for all participants and stakeholders, no barriers to entry, greater freedom of choice, level the playing field, increase competition, and ultimately reduce cost to the benefit of the consumers. I may be one of the last, but I think I'm certainly one of the shortest. I'd like to once again thank the Honourable Chair and the members of the committee for the opportunity to present.
Thank you very much. Questions and clarities? Thank you very much for your input. We might just come back to you for any further written inputs. Thank you. Next we have the National Clothing Retail Federation of South Africa, Mr. Michael Lawrence. Can we just wait? I see members leaving their chairs. Okay, let's continue. My apology for that.
Honourable Chair, honourable members, thank you very much for the opportunity to present. Chair, in the context of our written submission and in the comments to be made this morning, I think we need to emphasise that we recognise that a number of the concerns that we have already been addressed and would be more eruditely and intelligently and insightfully even addressed by some of our credit provider colleagues and some of the associations to which some of our members already belong. What we hope to do today, Chair, is to touch on some of the nuances that affect the clothing retail sector in particular. It might speak to one or two broader issues around retail, slightly more in general, and then just to identify very shortly, we're not intending to be long, just to identify very shortly some areas of concern that we want to highlight. But we do want to say that by virtue of not addressing certain of the issues that have been that may have been addressed previously, it doesn't mean we're not supporting them. We certainly think some points have already been very well made, both in written submissions and in respect of submissions to this committee. Chair, for the sake of introduction, I indicate who the specific members of the Clothing Retail Federation are, and the reason I highlight these specific members, as I've indicated earlier, is typically your average South African often starts their credit journey by wanting to buy a shirt or a blouse or a pair of socks. It's a fairly standard process, and so very often we're the very first port of call for someone who wants to access credit. It's a scary process. But we're a safe place, an easy place for the consumer to come to. We very much would like it to stay that way. We begin to develop an accountability relationship, and I'm not going to bore the committee with the value and merit of credit in successful economies, but what the committee, I think, has taken cognizance of, not just this morning but over a number of presentations, is of the importance of the consumer in developing appropriate skills in how they use and manage their access to credit that we provide them with. I want to say also about, Chair, about clothing retail. We have a couple of peculiarities. It's if a consumer becomes stressed, it's very expensive for us to try and recover the kind of obligations that they have to us. So we don't typically easily access some of the more onerous and forms of getting hold of such as EAOs and the like. It's not typical in our environment. It's occasional more often than not. And so we have to be very mindful of the way in which we offer credit. It's also a little difficult, Chair, to repossess a shirt once it's been used. It's a lot simpler for other providers of goods to repossess and get some active value out of those repossessed goods. But we really do struggle with those opportunities. Primarily, we're looking for good, healthy relationships with our consumer. We rely immensely on the integrity of the information they give us, both in respect of the income income streams, and we take broad income ranges into account, Chair, and in respect of the existing expenditure obligations, and we recognise there are complexities that folk face. I have put a little caveat in this introduction that I'm going to be speaking primarily to issues that are broad and across our sector. Obviously, there are various nuances within our individual membership models which may not specifically fit the comments I make. Chair, having given that introduction to our membership, I should also say this, Chair, about our membership. It is established by Statistics South Africa that 70% of clothing sold in this country is imported, and we understand most of that is imported from the East. But Chair, of the 30% of South African clothing, the significant volume of South African-made clothing that is sold in this country is sold in the stores that are defined in that membership list there. That is where South African-produced clothing is sold. So that critical link between consumers and consumer access to locally manufactured clothing goods, and we've all heard different stories, and for some of us they may be come across as horror stories about the struggles of the manufacturing component of the clothing value chain. We urge Chair that it be recognized that access to credit is an important part of our business. Access for the consumer to credit is an important part of our business model, but an equally important part of our business model is that we are active supporters of locally manufactured goods, and insofar as we make the consumer excessively price sensitive, it would make our clothing procurement models very, very difficult. Chair, moving on to the social dialogue process. It is a matter of deep concern to us. I am aware, because I'm involved at NEDLAC, that a request was made to the DTI that this particular amendment bill be submitted to DTI. And the reason we asked for that, Chair, was because there is a different nuance of conversation and a different potential of collective and common understanding that takes place in the social dialogue process. And the fact that we at NEDLAC have received no reply from the DTI in respect of this submission is a matter of concern to us. There was no immediate and evident urgency that made the bypassing of NEDLAC necessary, and so we do comment on that as a concern. We also, Chair, are very concerned about the fact that in the original drafting of this bill, we weren't, and we expressed this in different stages, we weren't very impressed with the public participation process. Public participation requires a level of robustness, a level of opportunity to hear and respond to issues, and we know that the amendment bill has changed significantly from the first process, the first draft around which public participation took place, and there hasn't been that same level of public participation. There's a sense of inevitability by the time the bill reaches this particular public hearing stage. Chair, then, to touch on the more specific issues, And as I've said, they're not going to be many because we're looking only at nuances. But let us touch on firstly on the issue which I've broadly labelled as code of conduct for this presentation. Chair, we're looking at the fact that we're quite concerned about the fact that voluntary behaviour agreements or voluntary associations are not appropriately acknowledged. The code of conduct should not be a document of the regulator or legislator. A code of conduct should be a document defined, drawn up, agreed to by particular participants, stakeholders within the industry. There is enough opportunity for the regulator themselves to regulate, and there is enough opportunity for the legislator to legislate. And if there are elements of a code of conduct that is presented to the regulator that are inconsistent with the regulation and or legislation, obviously that needs to be changed. And there is every opportunity within the framework for a code of conduct to be, for changes to be requested by the regulator to be made to a code of conduct. Chair, we have similar concerns around, for example, the voluntary associations that are that go along with ombuds, and the various attempts sincere attempts that have been made by industry to operate to provide industry based solutions, which we haven't achieved a maturity of understanding between ourselves and industry, other stakeholders, including consumer bodies. And the regulatory space and operators in particular. And we do urge, Chair, that there be clear delineation between legislation and regulation, and then those activities such as codes of conduct, such as ombuds, such as associations, which are very necessary. In fact, we urge that the granting of credit licenses and the granting of access to operate within the credit provision space actually be underpinned by a requirement that there be appropriate and significant participation in many of these kind of voluntary association activities that we've identified here. Chair, we cannot ignore the provision within the amendment to deal with credit information amnesty. I know a number of my colleagues have addressed it. It's a matter of significant concern to us, as I've indicated at the beginning of my presentation, Chair. We are a first port of call for many consumers, and if our access to information now suggests that we cannot distinguish between a brand new consumer who has never been in any way, shape, form or size delinquent in the activity in the credit space, and we cannot distinguish between that person and someone who is apparently has no delinquency, but that is only a result of information that is no longer available to us because it has been wiped off what we traditionally use as mechanisms for assessing the creditworthiness, the riskworthiness, and the responsible behavior of the consumer. We are enormously concerned about that change. It is going to result in our having to penalize potential new entrants. It is going to limit the availability of what credit we can make available. And I think our most significant concern, Chair, is that we will be forcing the consumer, who now has far, far, far more rigorous and patently unfair demands being made on them, it will force them to find credit in environments which are not as accountable as ours are. So we must make comment on the fact that the provision for credit amnesty does concern us immensely. I will touch very briefly also on the issue around affordability assessment. We are having a very robust and interesting conversation under the leadership of the regulator right now in respect of looking at the formalizing the affordability assessment guidelines, and it is our hope here that we not end up becoming an environment where we are in effect a nanny state, where in effect decisions around accountability and responsibility are taken out of the hands of the consumer the opportunities for freedom of choice are not appropriately contextualized by the roles and responsibilities that they themselves might have, but that we will ultimately end up with an environment which allows an intelligent learning process and robust of the use of credit to emerge at the end of the process. I have two more slides, Chair. The second to last is, and again, we touch on some more elements in our more formal presentation for this purpose. I'm reminded of some other areas of my life I'm involved in on a volunteer basis. A gentleman in the 18th century by the name of Ignaz Semmelweis, obstetrician, discovered that his patients' mortality, both for mothers and infants, was significantly improved by the simple act of washing his hands. And his colleagues in the industry chain completely ignored him and derided him because they said the business of people living and dying must be far more complicated than the simplicity of washing of hands. We worry, Chair, about processes where we extend the broadness of power that is contained in Section 83. We worry about the fact that it doesn't have clear definition in terms of what exactly can and can't be done by both the regulator and by the tribunal. We worry about the fact, Chair, that it be overcomplicated and that we might in fact be setting ourselves up for lengthy and expensive processes that have to be established through case law rather than for finding some form of simpler process. And in similar vein, and Chair, please, this is not an attack on the integrity or processes of the NCR as it currently exists. I think we are increasingly developing healthy and vibrant relationships in that space as a sector. But certainly there is enforcement indicated here in Section 140, which is very, very broad, and we believe is intentionally so. And we do need to ensure that the NCR sticks to its core areas of concern, that it doesn't become all kinds of enforcement to all kinds of opportunities. There are areas which can be addressed, possibly even on a voluntary basis, but certainly on a formal basis by tribunals or courts. And as I said, on a voluntary basis, even by ombuds or ADRs. And if we turn, it's often said, if you turn something into a hammer, everything it will want to see everything as being a nail. And we certainly don't want the NCRs to become an entity that it was never intended to become. We speak specifically of the future of that person. Chair, in conclusion, we thank the committee for the opportunity to present again. We look forward to opportunities, as we keep saying, for robust conversation. There are a number of areas in the application of what is intended in the bill where we believe that changes and tweaking will need to be the result of aggressive and again to use the word robust conversation with stakeholders, and if we leave the committee with nothing else, it is that we expect that robust conversation will become the way of doing business rather than the exception to the process. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I will now take hands for questions and clarities, but just before that, let me just alert the DDI. I think I heard Mr. Lawrence suggesting that DDI didn't respond to something, or you didn't make reference to that. I must have misheard you. Okay. If that is the case, then that's fine. But at some point, we'll ask the DDI to make their own input as well. Members? Honorable Waile, followed by Honorable Hill Lewis, Honorable Mabasa, in that order.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairperson. I think consistently with what you posed earlier on, I think there was a kind of a statement that DTI has not responded. I don't know whether on the issue of social dialogue at NEDLAC level. I think that's the context in which you have made that particular statement. So we need a clarity on that, because we quite understand that these things are quite involved and also require number of stakeholders, especially in the broad mainstream of the economy. The second question relates to the issue of the code of conduct. It seems as if there is an emphasis from your presentation that you would better consider that the industry itself, I don't know whether you'll correct me, it seems as if your posture is that the industry must do what is called self-regulation. But the question on issues which we are dealing with are societal in current, and they've got far-reaching implications, and government or the state becomes a custodian of ensuring that all role players behave in a particular fashion. That's why there are these pieces of legislation. I think the last issue is the national credit regulator. I think there seems to be a concern, but which has not been explicit from you, as to what is this concern in terms of the national credit regulator, in terms of the enforcement, and what clarities. I think you must begin to tease out some of those areas which you require clarity, so that we don't become vague on some of those issues. Thanks very much, Commissioner. Honorable Lewis.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I've just got two questions on your submission. The first is actually for the department, I think, because the comments on section 129, I see exactly what you're saying there. What is the difference between any dispute and in section 1 and any other dispute in section 2? I think that's quite a valid point. I don't really see the difference there between those two sections. And then to you, Mr. Lawrence, you seem to indicate some concern with the section on affordability guidelines, section 82. What exactly is your concern about having prescribed guidelines for affordability tests? Is it that most of your members, the credit access will be limited by such guidelines? I'd just like to get a better picture of what the concern actually is.
Honourable Mawas.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. My question is, there is an area on page 2, the third bullet from the bottom, where it says, propose include a provision that requires an open and transparent public participation process. This very exercise is a public consultation process. So how does the presenter propose be improved beyond what it is? And then the second point is the NCR is proposing an extension of its power. Where previously discretion was given to courts to suspend credit agreement, this is being extended to the National Credit Tribunal. If we look at how courts are occupied by various cases, and if we look at the fact that some of these cases do not see the light of the day in court simply because courts are over extended, will the presenter not agree that the tribunal will timeously intervene so that it should be welcome? You know, that's my impression. So if the presenter could speak to that. I think what will the presenter propose should substitute NCR and NCT? Because I get the impression that you don't appreciate these bodies. You know, is it that I'm not getting the right impression? You know, if you could, and if you agree to that statement, then what should substitute them? Thanks, colleague chair.
Honourable McIntosh.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for the presentation. It's good to know you're the guy selling South African clothes rather than Indonesian, Bangladeshi, and Chinese and Indian. The question I want is your membership. You don't mention PEP stores as being a member. And then Mr. Price, as I understand it, when I've ever been there, they pay cash. So why are they members if they don't do give credit? They do give credit, okay. But and what about, there are one or two other chains of stores which are selling clothing extensively. And the other big sellers, certainly in Johannesburg, if you walk around, are Ethiopian traders. The Ethiopians are big in the clothing business. Have you made any efforts to involve these people in the organization, or do they prefer to stay below the parapet?
Your response is, Mr. Lorenz. Thank you, Chair. Sorry, an apology to you, Chair. The issue of the DTI response was not around this process, which I thought was what you were alluding to. It was around the NEDLAC response. NEDLAC in November sent a note to the Minister asking if this bill could be submitted to NEDLAC for as part of its agenda in the context of the social dialogue process. When I checked with NEDLAC yesterday, by that point, no response had been received from the department. So, Chair, I think if that is a particular matter which I can put on the record, it is real. And we at NEDLAC have just recognised that it is a bit after the fact now, so I'm certainly not asking for the process to go back to NEDLAC. I'm just expressing a concern. To the member's question around the issue of the code of conduct, we don't want to remove the right of regulator and or legislator to deal with the societal issues at all. In fact, what we're saying is establish a broad framework, rules of the game, that address the societal issues you want to, but allow within the context of that regulatory and legislative space, allow nevertheless the opportunity for industry sectors and other stakeholders to look at establishing voluntary-based agreements, which cannot be inconsistent with legislation or regulation, and which can even ultimately result in a feed into a formalization. There may be voluntary processes, Honourable Member, which can move from being informal to being formally included in the regulatory space. So we're certainly not suggesting that the regulator not regulate or the legislator not legislate. What is important is to provide the space for accountable conversations and agreements to take place, which are not anti-competitive, to take place between key stakeholders within the sector. To the member's question on our concerns around enforcement, it speaks very broadly that there can be that
there is enforcement that can take place. What we don't understand is there a limitation? Is there nevertheless an appeal that can go back to court? There was another member who asked me to speak on the issue of the NCR's extensions of powers. Our concern is just that the bill is not sufficiently clear. It may well become clearer as part of a regulatory space at some later stage. But the enforcement that we're quite specifically speaking to, we believe, is incredibly broad at this stage. It doesn't give, and we're not comfortable yet that the track record of right of reply and affording right to respond is sufficiently there. We understand that a regulator looks at societal issues, but we as credit providers are equally a part of societal issues, and we don't want a situation where just because someone makes a complaint and someone then has the power to, for example, cancel an agreement, that we're then stuck between the proverbial rock and hard place and can't go anywhere, and it's not sufficiently clear. It's excessive, it's extreme, and as I indicated earlier, if you turn someone into a hammer, they will treat everything like a nail, whereas this needs to be a more robust kind of conversational space. And dare I say, in the context of the earlier comment around code of conduct, if in fact there were mechanisms for resolution between a consumer and a credit provider, even before the NCR, we may well have just the worst of worst cases reaching the NCR, which would further place burden on the NCR to look at what the interaction was and what the key elements of the difference are between differences are in understanding of the conflict between the credit provider and the consumer. So we just think it's a broad sweeping drop in into the act, which could have unintended consequences downstream and might require all kinds of case law to tidy up, and we just worry about that. I was asked to speak to the issues and concerns around affordability guidelines. Our major concern there is quite simple. We are in our business incredibly reliant on the integrity of a consumer's submission of information. For example, often within households that apply to clothing stores for credit, they will indicate as a stream of income, income from a room that is being rented out to a family member. For us to find the right kind of documentation that confirms that, we just get very worried when you then say, well, there needs to be a document that confirms that lease agreement or that rental agreement. What's an appropriate document? Must it be signed by both parties? Must it be signed by an attorney? Must it be signed as an affidavit? The potential for fraud becomes very, very complicated. We are not flippant about information that is presented to us in support of how we do affordability tests ourselves and run our scorecards on the suitability of a consumer for credit and the quantum of credit. We are certainly not flippant, but we just get very worried when you provide an over-regulated space and requirement, and unintentionally all you do is increase the sophistication of fraud that takes place along with it. So, but as I did indicate in the respect of this conversation, Chair, this is an ongoing and robust conversation in a task team at the NCR, and so we're just speaking to the extent to which there's a dynamic that a door that may be opened and difficult to close within the Act. But certainly we have some measure of comfort around the conversation that is taking place at the NCR right now. Chair, in respect of Section 82, the matter around Section 82 around public participation process, I hope I've recorded the context of this question correctly, but the assertion was made that this in itself is a public process.
Chair, there are nuances in conversation which can happen very differently with all due respect to this portfolio committee. There are nuances in conversation that can happen very differently at NEDLAC, where there are defined experts from social dialogue partners in government, labour and business having a conversation that is notably different from a public participation where a whole lot of people are invited to come and be in a room and there is almost a free-for-all conversation irrespective of any limitations on who is there. It has its place and space, but it is a very different conversation as compared to a presentation which involves a public hearing such as this. We believe that in our collective understanding of the issues addressed by this Act, we need to be as broad in spectrum and as robust in outcome as possible in the way in which we engage with each other. There is good opportunity for all of us to learn, and we're certainly not arrogant ourselves to believe that we have all the answers. There are important lessons to be learned from other stakeholders, not just our credit-providing colleagues, but other stakeholders in the industry. In respect of the NCR extension of powers that is indicated, as I said, we've touched on that a little bit around enforcement and some of its powers. We are quite worried that this does require some better form of definition. It's not clear how and where the role of ombuds would work in respect of these conversations. It's not immediately clear to us, and I may be missing something. I'm not a lawyer. How and where the courts fit directly in respect of this conversation, and certainly while we would want to alleviate stress on our formal judicial system, we just think that there needs to be appropriate context and definition given to the way in which those powers are provided. Otherwise, someone is in any case going to challenge for those rights within the formal legislative system, within the judiciary process, and we could have all kinds of complications emerging from those processes. And then finally, sir, in respect of our in respect of the Clothing Retail Federation's membership, it's a voluntary association. The members who are there, the members who sell clothes, who have chosen to join other clothing retailers, it's perfectly welcome to join. We make no limitation. I did say that we don't only sell South African clothing, but we are the significant seller of what South African clothing is in fact manufactured. I have to admit for the record, that the quantum of clothing in our stores is still quite significantly of an imported nature, and that is by and large because of our response to the demands of our consumers and the way in which they make their particular clothing purchase. But sir, if you know of any persons who might want to apply for membership to my organization, you're welcome to send them my contact details. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I'm not going to allow for a tea break because we are doing almost fine with time. We only have one presentation left. It would do us better to take tea as we close the meeting. But before we go on to the last presentation, DTI, would you like to make any comments on? Not now. Okay. The last presentation is from the Black Debt Counselors Forum, represented by Advocate. No. We have here the name of Miss Tandi Nhlengeto, but I'm told there's been a change of plan. Can you please introduce yourself before you make your input?
of sharing. I'm Keystone Solar, and I'm with the National Chairperson of the Black Death Councillors Forum, Thandi Nhlengeto. Our presentation today is going to focus on certain sections of the bill, but we need to state up front that we, as Black Death Councillors, support the effort that has been made to try and improve the situation with regard to Black Death Counselling and by extension enabling Black Death Councillors to assist consumers who may not be in a position to negotiate on an equal footing with credit providers. So as we see, our debt counseling has been very critical in terms of the National Credit Act. Our focus is going to be on certain sections that we strongly feel as the BDCF need to be looked into, so that it avoids any contradiction and any conflict that arises when such matters have not been addressed in the bill. Now, the first one is the voluntary debt mediation. We come from a situation where voluntary debt mediation was done outside of the provisions of Section 86. And our concern is that Section 86.7b of the National Credit Act, as well as Section 86.8, provide for voluntary debt mediation. And that process is clearly facilitated during the debt counseling process, because the outcome thereof becomes a consent order, which has the same status as a magistrate's court order or a tribunal order. So it becomes binding to all the parties involved. But we also acknowledge that there are challenges that are brought about that need to be looked at with regard to the voluntary debt mediation. When we look at Section 129A, it provides for credit provider to engage consumers who are in default. And what then happens is that kind of arrangement that is made, the question is, what is the legal status of that arrangement? Because there are certain developments that come out of that. By the time the consumer approaches a debt counselor, the credit provider is in possession of a consent to judgment as an arrangement that was made. And all those kinds of things compromise the whole process. But also, we have challenges where, you know, voluntary debt mediation is done outside of Section 86, 7B in particular. But our conclusion is basically that given the provisions of Section 86, 7B in particular, VDM, which is voluntary debt mediation, may only be done through Section 86, because then it protects the consumer and it ensures that the credit provider is equally protected in the whole agreement, because such an agreement will then be taken to the tribunal so that it becomes a consent order and it becomes part and parcel of the debt review process. We also look at Section 129A, where the bill does not begin to address the status of the agreement that is reached between a credit provider and a consumer when a consumer is in default. Because we are faced as debt counselors with situations where an agreement is reached to address arrears, but when you look at the agreement, the arrears are spread over a period of 4 months, where an installment was initially 1,000 rands, now there's a commitment to pay 1,350 per month when the consumer could not afford 1,000, hence they were in default. Now, such agreements are entered into, and we are saying those should not be converted into either an offer to settle or a consent to judgment, so that they should be just arrangements, so that they don't exclude a consumer from seeking assistance of a debt counsellor even after entering into such an agreement. Because when those documents are produced at the later stage, then it becomes a complicated matter, because then the credit provider immediately approaches a court, you know, to make sure that offer to settle is recorded as an agreement and it becomes an order. We're also looking at Regulation 27 of the Act, and I think we feel very strong that given the provisions of Section 3, which is the purpose of the Act, and in particular Section 3A, which basically emphasizes the issue of access to credit, so that the current status of Regulation 27 by implication means if a consumer who is under debt review and their mortgage bond is part of the debt review process, it means they are excluded from the credit market for the next 30 years or so, depending on how long they are going to finish paying their mortgage bond. So we basically note that as debt counselors, we do extend mortgage bonds up to 30 years. We're not adding 30 years on the remaining years, but we say normally it's 20 years, so we play around it, but you can extend it up to 30 years. But there are also other credit agreements that are being restructured, which may be short to medium term. But now the current Regulation 27 provides that there should be full satisfaction of all debt obligations before a clearance certificate is issued. But also, what it means is that a consumer would be excluded from the credit market until the clearance certificate is issued. So if a bond is part of that, then it means it's another 30 years. Now, it contradicts the provisions of Section 3A, which is about accessibility. So it gives the impression that when you apply for debt review, you are excluded from the credit market. Now, having looked at that, we then recommend that we consider amending that regulation so that it provides that a clearance certificate would be issued when all shorter obligations are satisfied and the mortgage bond should not be in arrears at that time, so that a person can then be able to access the credit industry or the credit market as soon as they've settled all these overbearing credit agreements. But then the mortgage bond should not be in arrears at that time when a consideration is made whether a clearance certificate should be issued or not. Now, we basically are looking at Section 83A, where we're looking at a bill amending subsection 86.2, which subsection focuses on 86.2. 86.2 focuses on the steps that a credit provider takes, because we've had quite a number of judgments that were contradictory in terms of the process initiated by Section 129 notice. Now, that has sought to clarify the process. We appreciate that, because then we are not going to be faced with credit providers who do not respond to an application but merely say we have dispatched a 129 notice, therefore that that credit agreement cannot be part of the debt review process. But we also acknowledge and consider the amendment that was that has been proposed on the bill with regard to Section 86.10. But then when we look at Section 88.3a as it stands in the Act, we realize that it can be viewed as a loophole by credit providers, because in this whole scheme of work in debt review, we are faced with a situation where the reality is that some credit providers are not prepared to accept the debt review process. So anything that the loophole they exploit to make sure that debt review doesn't work when it comes to those agreements. So when we look at Section 88.3, we're looking at paragraph A in particular to say, as it reads, that the consumer is in default under the credit agreement. We've had quite a number of challenges to say it looks fake, because then it doesn't specify what credit agreement we're talking about. So what we are then proposing in that regard, we're recommending that we amend that 88.3a so that it just includes the phrase that is subject to debt review, so it becomes very specific that we are talking about a default on a credit agreement that is subject to debt review. Because when we talk about debt review, there are two agreements basically running simultaneously. That is the original agreement and the debt review agreement. So we believe that if we become specific in terms of 88.3a, then we are not going to even have to have debates or adjudications that have to be done by court to determine which of these agreements we're talking about. But then we also look at the same section, but in this instance we're looking at Section 83b2. Now, Section 83b2, what is very interesting for us is that the agreement that was initiated or that we referred to in Section 129 still comes into the picture in Section 88.3b2. Now, we are then saying, instead of looking at that agreement as being an agreement that can be that can determine whether there should be litigation, because those kind of agreements are done when a consumer is in default, and there are these rules that consumers use wherein arrears can only be spread over a certain period of time. And you can imagine that at that point in time, the consumer has been threatened with repossession of their assets, and they just sign to say, yes, I can pay that amount, when in reality they cannot. So we cannot use such agreements as agreements that will determine whether there should be litigation or not. Hence, our recommendation is that we replace, you know, those rearrangements agreed between the consumer and the credit provider with consent order, because the consent order is a rearrangement agreement, but it was facilitated by a third party, and therefore the consumer becomes protected in that regard. So you don't come out and you realize more money was demanded from an over-indebted consumer, and because they could not pay, therefore litigation has to happen. And the sub-paragraph, as it says, basically promotes that. So we are basically recommending that we re-look at that and try to see how we can tighten it up so that we do not find a situation where the intention is actually compromised by the way, you know, the wording of the Act is structured. Now, before I thank you, I think it's important that we need to request that especially the department find a way of dealing with within the bill itself, Section 140, Now, Section 140 becomes a challenge, especially when we look at Section 141D. Now, 141D becomes a challenge in that a referral of a matter to the National Prosecution Authority by its nature suggests that there is a criminal offense that was committed. But when you look at that subparagraph as it stands, it means an official in the NCR must investigate first and then refer to the NPA. And one imagines, and as the BDCF, we basically are asking ourselves as to whether the officials in the NCR have the right type of training to investigate to the extent of referring to the NPA. And we are basically saying, let's look at that so that if there is an allegation and there's a preliminary investigation that could be conducted by the officials in the NCR, what we recommend is that out of that preliminary investigation, then the NPA can be brought into the picture so that a broader and more informed investigation is done, because there's a lot of fraudulent activities happening in the credit industry, and as debt counselors we come across all those kind of things on a daily basis. But then the question is, how are they supposed to be handled? Thank you very much.
Over to you, members. Honorable Hill Lewis, Honorable Sonepo, in that order.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, Honorable Wiley.
Thank you very much, sir. Just before I ask my question, won't you just show us to that section where you want the investigation? What section was that you were referring to?
140. 1D.
141?
140.
1D. I see. Okay. Well, let me just make some comments. If you could just go back one page on your presentation to your amendments. Over there. Thanks. You see, when I read how you've edited A and Roman 2, it almost reads as though it's referring to exactly the same thing. You see, if the consumer is in default under the agreement that is subject of the review, and if they are in default of any obligation in terms of an agreement that's subject to a consent order, that is the exact same thing, isn't it? That's how I understand it. So I'd like to get your response on that. Then on the third one, 140, you're making a suggestion that they do a preliminary investigation first. Again, that's how I understand it to read currently. It says after completing an investigation into a complaint, that is the preliminary investigation. So are you suggesting that in practice the NCR is making that investigation too thorough an investigation and thereby delaying the criminal justice process? That may well be the case, and then perhaps there's an opportunity for us to clear up that interpretation to suggest it's just a preliminary investigation to establish prima facie evidence to refer to the NPA. That might be a way of clearing it up, and I'll just make a note of that. But thanks for a very useful presentation.
Honorable Sonepo.
Thank you very much for that presentation. From your experience, I'd just like to find out whether you come across debt incurred where no affordability tests were done. Does it happen? I'm aware of a person that incurred huge medical expenses without any affordability test being done, and then that had a major impact on his ability to service other debts. So how is that dealt with? And where affordability tests have been done, in your experience, have those tests been fair, or have they just gone through the motions to in fact grant the credit? What is your experience on that?
Honorable Wife.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation, which has been so informative. The first question that I want to pose relates to the issue of the agreement not to be converted into the settlement offer. Can you expatiate more, but based on experiences? Because we're raising these issues because some people enter to these processes without being intellectually armed as compared to the credit providers, because there's always the serious problem in terms of the power relations. Can you just illustrate some of the experiences? The second one relates to the Regulation 27 and also the clearance certificate, because there seems to be, I'm getting an impression that this person is highly indebted, and over and above that there's a process of the review or restructured debt. It seems as if, do you suggest a window opportunity whilst this particular person is still engulfed by the same problem of the debt spiral? I'm not getting, I need more clarity on that. And the last one, you have raised, and consistently a number of speakers have been raising the issues that there's a high fraudulent activities that are happening within this particular industry. You'd find number of people in the value chain. But what is the magnitude of that fraudulent activities? Are the measures that are in place and the institutions that are in place, whether from judiciary and all over, are they not effective and sufficient enough to deal with? Or is there any kind of collaboration or syndicates in that particular process? I think I'm consistent with that. Even yesterday, I've said that you would find that there are people who are robbing every day, but carrying pangas. It seems as here there is a sophisticated robbery by people who are highly professional, who are supposed to, in terms of their integrity, they are supposed to be the custodians of building a better nation, but also a nation which is not engulfed. Because if you do that to a simple person, helpless person, where else must ordinary people run to? So I think what should be done, because to me I just feel that we need to declare a state of emergency insofar as this particular aspect. Thanks very much.
Honorable McIntosh.
Mr. Chairman, no, I just want to make a comment. I think this has been a very good presentation. It's obviously on the ground. You deal with it all the time, and it's short and it's sweet, and it raises the concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your responses?
With regard to the question of the agreement subject to debt review versus the consent order. An agreement that is subject to debt review is part of a process that will culminate to an order. And a consent order is the product on its own. So that's the difference between the two. Because if we refer to an earlier section in the Act, Section 86.7 C and B, and we look at the proposed section 86.10 in the bill. The bill refers to a process where a credit provider may not terminate that review when the matter is before a court or a tribunal. Now, that is basically an agreement that is subject to debt review at that stage. But if we get a court order, then we've got a product of a process. So those two are not necessarily do not necessarily refer to the same thing. One becomes a product, and one will be considered as a process leading up to the product. Now, what kind of investigation is currently conducted by the NCR? Now, when we look at that section 140 in terms of what the current situation is that there are the types of complaints that are complicated, that are criminal in nature, and include a lot of fraud, do not seem to be completed. And we don't blame the regulator, but we blame the capacity to deal with those issues. Hence, we say, when we look at 141D, it needs to be stated in such a way that where there is prima facie evidence, let the matter be referred directly to the NPA or to the Hawks, because they are specialized in dealing with those matters, so that the regulator does not sit and conduct an investigation on fraud where this syndicate becomes very sophisticated. And that is what the situation is currently, where fraudulent allegations are made. Such investigations are never completed because people are not capacitated. So that's what we basically would respond in terms of the kind of investigation that is currently happening. Now, the issue of assessment and how that is dealt with, I think we need to impress upon the House to realize that the industry that we find ourselves in as debt counselors is very complex. I had one member saying, asking a question earlier on as to whether we are aware that, you know, consumers become desperate, they want money, they want credit and all that. Now, that desperation by consumers we see happening with credit providers as well, where credit providers need to make a profit and they are desperate to make a profit. So the whole issue of assessment is compromised along the way, and unfortunately is compromised to the detriment of the consumer. And by the time the debt counselor comes into the picture, it becomes more complicated, because then the debt counselor has to look at the whole process of assessment, where we find assessment in some instances does not exist, you know, because the Act provides for that anyway. But I want to believe that the department and the regulator will be looking at that in terms of the assessment criteria, because the Act now provides assistance, provides for any future prospects, you know, as a way of a credit provider assessing whether the person will afford or not. Now, what is future prospect? What if things don't happen in future? You know, how do we consider that? Was it assessed or not? But as we have the Act as it stands, there is provision that where no assessment was properly done, the debt counselor could be looking at reckless lending in that regard. But I need to point out that I think the move in the form of the bill, moving the issue of reckless lending to be dealt with by the tribunal as well, is going to make life easy for everybody. Because currently it has always been very complicated to prove reckless lending in court, even if you could see it. Now, if it goes to the tribunal, I think it will make things easier, and more cases of reckless lending would then be dealt with at the tribunal. Now, an agreement between the consumer and the credit provider not to be converted into a legal document. Now, what the experience we have, especially when a consumer walks in and needs assistance, But when you communicate with a credit provider, they produce an emolument attachment order, you know, a garnish order. And they attach documents to that. And one of the documents was a consent judgment that was signed by the consumer at a point where they were addressing their arrears. And that is the point we're trying to emphasize here. To say the agreement between the consumer and the credit provider in terms of Section 129 should have a clear objective to deal with the arrears, how best to deal with the arrears. But let's bear in mind that the consumer does not have may not have the ability to negotiate for an extension of the credit agreement, like a debt canceller would. So you don't have a balance in that environment. Because in most instances, a consumer is called in by a collection agency. Already the matter has been handed over, and who's a collecting agent is a practicing attorney. Then you have a consumer and an attorney having to negotiate an agreement. And that is the point that we say needs to be addressed in the bill, so that it brings about that balance in power. Hence our emphasis that any form of legal agreement, as provided for in the Act, would have to be dealt with in terms of Section 86. So that agreement in terms of 129, it's fine. Let it be done. They have the right to engage. But it should not be converted into a legal agreement, because there was no balance of power in the process of settlement. Then when it comes to Regulation 27, our view is not to create a window period. Our view is that a consumer who is over indebted in 2010, and there's debt review that runs for 5 years, as an example. Now, after 5 years, when they have paid all those debts that they had, except for the bond, it means their financial situation has improved, because now they have more disposable income, because they have settled all those debts. Now, what we are then looking at is that, by the way, the bond was also restructured. Now, the person is now in a better position. They can access credit, but then they are bogged down with this bond that was also extended. So all we're saying is, let us look at the bill in relation to that regulation, so that we find a way either to bring back the 30 years to 20 years, or we leave it as it is, but the person should be able to access credit. Because then everybody will look at debt review as a debt sentence, like it has been happening when many people were emphasizing the issue of more interest paid when you are under debt review, you know. So people who were over indebted were not eager to get into debt review because of that. So we're not looking at a window period, but we're saying let's think about how best to bring them back into the industry as soon as they've settled the medium and short-term debts. Now, fraudulent activities in the industry, I'm sure our media is covering some, but I could say in terms of the magnitude, there are those that are going unabated, and we only see the tip of the iceberg every time we read in the media. For instance, there's this focus now on garnish orders. Yeah. And when you look at the number that is being vended around, that is not the number that is actually facing consumers. So you look at the type of this type of activity which is not receiving attention yet, which is very big as well. The issue of those consent to judgment. Those are fraudulent activities that needs to be dealt with. Hence we are saying if we deal with Section 129, we will be able to start containing that whole process. Because those garnish orders are merely granted based on those consent to judgments. But it is happening big time. Now, As to how these are being dealt with, unfortunately, it's still the same issue that we're trying to propose with regard to Section 140. Because as long as we keep these fraudulent investigations within the SDR, we are not going to deal with all these fraudulent activities. So anything that looks like fraud needs to be investigated so that a determination is made by experts to say, no, there was no fraud. Because we know of a credit provider who has been providing credit for the past whatever number of years without a registration number. You know, and a further investigation indicated that they do not even have a tax number, but they charge tax, no VAT number, they are not registered with the DTI, but they are granting credit. And all the complaints that were thrown to the NCR could not be completed because of the capacity to deal with such. So yes, we're looking at how, you know, these fraudulent activities need to be dealt with because they are really wide. Now, what should be done to deal with all the fraudulent activities? I think our proposal was made earlier. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Honorable Helios, do you want to make a follow-up? Is it a new question?
It's a follow-up.
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to ask, how is it that we can ban the use of those consent to judgments? Is there a particular thing that we can insert in here, or is it a regulatory restriction that needs to be done by the NCR?
May you repeat the question?
How is it that we can restrict the use of credit providers forcing consumers to sign those consent to judgments for the emolument attachment orders?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think off my head, when we look at the three other activities that are there in Section 129, there is reporting on that. So my view is that we could then look at the legislation in such a way that reporting is also done with regard to the arrangements that are done between consumers and credit providers. Then we would be able to pick up what type of agreements those are. Because when they are done, they are put in the file. And the only time you discover that is when there's a garnish order or when there's a default judgment. So at the point where they occur, unfortunately, when you look at the industry, you realize it's a file that is confidential, you know, and people can't just access those kind of files. But I think some kind of reporting mechanisms would have to be thought of so that it begins to inform about the outcome of such agreements. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me just make a few closing remarks. In the past 3 days, couple of things have come up in the course of the public hearings on this amendment bill, which the committee will have to take into account and as it deliberates on the final amendments. Let me just say that a number of role players have come up in the course of the deliberations. Role players in the credit industry, direct and indirect, role players, represented in different shapes and sizes. A range of the cost of credit, obvious and not so obvious, direct and indirect costs of credit have also been highlighted here. Very importantly, in the past 2 days,
an issue has been raised as well about the effects of the cost of credit, or rather the effects of the burden of debt on the consumers. And I suppose the burden of unpaid debt to the creditors as well. And these are issues that we need to take into account. Different input makers have made proposals on further amendments on the bill. We'll take all of those into account. But there are four broad areas all of us must take responsibility for. All of us. Government, the private sector, the public, and everybody. And that is that we must remove reckless lending in the industry, which subject consumers to perpetual indebtedness. That I think all of us must take responsibility for. But we must also bring about a reasonable cost of credit which keeps the credit providers in business and competitive, but at the same time the costs of credit which are not over burdensome to the consumers. We must ensure that credit providers do business prudently, but equally we must assist the consumers to be prudent payers as well, so that our economy moves forward and moves up. Lastly, all of us have a responsibility to ensure that the availability of credit contributes to economic growth. It contributes to inclusive economic participation. Through availability to individual consumers, but also availability of credit to business. The SMMEs, the cooperatives, the broad manufacturing sector. We must ensure availability of credit that contributes to job creation. All of us have a responsibility to ensure all of this. And therefore, in summary, all of us without exception, have a responsibility to create a prosperous nation. If we fail, we must understand that the service delivery protests we see are not just a matter of lack of delivery of service by government, but are a matter of affordability of service that is provided by government as well. When people can't pay for electricity, can't pay for water, can't pay for refuse removal, and all the other local government services, local government, municipalities have no revenue and can't provide services. So if we look at service delivery protests as the government to people brutal requests, we have it all wrong.
we don't see the bigger picture. If we look at the wage strikes and conclude that these are employer-employee quarrels, we must then ask the question, if we think that we are not involved, we must ask ourselves the question, why do employers, or rather, why do workers have to go on protest to have their wages increased? What drives the cost of living to the extent that the workers and the poor can no longer afford and are forced to go to seek credit, which they equally cannot afford to repay? So, I want to emphasize we have a responsibility, all of us. All of us present here, and all of us who are not here, who are not part of this process, but players in the economy, in our different ways, and players in governance, at different layers of governance. So there we are. Let's be honest, let's be frank with each other, let's commit to creating this prosperous nation, because if we fail, at this level, this nation will have failed. Because we will have a situation which nobody will be able to control. And I don't think that we want to go that route. The private sector want to remain in business and grow and be competitive. Government wants to be able to govern this country successfully. The people of this country want to live reasonably comfortably and earn their living, and earn their living. So we have a responsibility. Thank you very much. This meeting stands adjourned. Tomorrow, let me just make this announcement. Tomorrow's meeting starts at 9 o'clock. We have, in this venue, we have the South African Reserve Bank, Judge Fleming, Ms. Arde, and Wonga, I think it's Wonga.com, who are coming to present. You're all welcome to come back tomorrow, if you can. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned. Hello, Jan. Okay, this is fun.